cannabis mission out in Elmer, Iowa. The voice who introduced me was that of Professor John Fitzgerald, Professor of Speech here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, where I am doing some work on my sabbatical. He was kind enough to let me use his machine to send this recorded tape to you. And the voice you are listening to now comes from a man who was privileged to go all the way around the planet Earth in about 50 days, traveling by air almost entirely. When I think of the great opportunity and privilege that was given me to make this trip around the world in behalf of the missions of our church, the only reason I can think of why this happened to me is the reason that St. Paul gives for his work in the first chapter of the letter to the Romans, where he says it was by the grace of God that he is a slave and apostle of Jesus Christ. It has been a privilege for me to be a pastor in the church, to be a professor at one of our seminaries, to be connected with the Bible and biblical teaching and theology, to be connected with the work of missions of our church, and it was certainly a great privilege, a gift of God's grace, that I was allowed to make this thrilling trip around the world, in which God's protecting angels kept us on their wings as well as on the wings of the jet planes as we went from country to country, because we went almost without mishap. This trip began last October, really, when the board of directors of our synod decided that one of the vice presidents of our church, and they chose Dr. Harms, the first vice president, should make a tour of the mission field before he was in office very long, so that he could better make decisions regarding the ever-expanding work of missions around the world. It has been said that Dr. Behnken, who loved missions a great deal, never had opportunity to do this until he was in office almost 20 years. They did not want to repeat this, so Dr. Harms was chosen to visit all the mission fields. Then also our church is realigning the missionary work and organization of our church. Before long, there will be two major boards of missions. The one will be for the work of home missions, the board of home missions. The other will be the board of world missions. This is the board in which we have been sitting on for the last 10 years, and it has been a thrilling experience. Dr. Harms, as he went about the world, was to look into how this alignment should be made. Also, his purpose was to visit the first convention of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in India, which our church has been instrumental in founding. That is, the funds and gifts that you folks in Iowa give, and where other people of our church give. Some of this money has gone to India for the last 68 years, and we have finally had, and by the grace of God, a new church started there. Dr. Harms wanted to go and visit the first convention of this church. Well, how do I fit into this? How did I fit into this picture? For what reason was I sent along? Well, for one reason, I could be sprung loose from my work since I was on sabbatical leave at the seminary after 10 years of teaching to do some refreshing research and study. Another reason was that I have been on the board for World Missions these years, and never has a member of the board which makes the decisions for World Missions gone on a tour such as this. Another reason is that on this board of missions, we have been serving as chairman of two committees, one the Committee on Foreign Seminaries and another a committee on the work that we are doing among the hospitals and so on. This other committee dealt with the Committee on Doctrine, too. Thus, I was asked to go along for Dr. Behnken in our church to visit all of the fields. In connection with this, we were also allowed to make a visit to such places which forms a great background for my teaching at the seminary, namely Italy, Rome, Greece, and Athens, where St. Paul visited and wrote parts of the New Testament, and also Palestine, where our Lord and the apostles walked and taught, and where our Lord died and rose again for the sins of the world. Well, to say the least, this was certainly something to be looked forward to. The next thing I want to do is to give you an itinerary of the trip. The itinerary was to take us from St. Louis to New York. We left here a few days after Christmas by jet plane from St. Louis at 9 in the morning, and we were in New York at noon, I guess it was, New York time. There we visited the offices of the American Lutheran Publicity Bureau of Dr. Hoffman, the Lutheran Hour speaker, and of our public relations office. And Dr. Harms and I had great opportunity to see how this operated. We also took in a few sights of New York that afternoon. It illustrates immediately how fast one can travel today. That evening at 9 o'clock, we left the airport, the International Airport in New York, and made a jet flight from New York to London. As I said, we left at 9 o'clock, and by the time we were settled in this fast jet plane and had eaten and had taken a little nap, the pilot broke radio silence and said, "Will you please fasten your seat belts? We are descending for London." Now, this was 2:15 in the morning already. That means that it was 7:15 in London. So this was the first night on the trip that we didn't get any sleep at all. As I recall, I believe there were three or four nights by traveling from east to west around the world that you catch up on daylight so fast that you do not get any night. Well, this enabled us to have many more hours of discussion and conferences with the men around the world. From London, where we visited our work under Dr. Pierce and his men who are doing great work in and around London, also in the northern part of England, we flew to Frankfurt. There, Dr. Harms wanted to visit the German seminary connected with the Lutheran Free Church, which educates men for the ministry suitable, similar to ours, and to look into granting them funds and in what way we could help them. We also visited military installations of chaplains and so forth, down in places like Heidelberg and up in Mannheim. We also in Munich, München. And I must say that Germany, I forgot to mention the great old city like Heidelberg with its university and its old castle. I must say that this was a country that took my eye and made me feel as though here I was in a country that of long tradition of great culture and learning. I was greatly pleased to be in Germany. It's a beautiful country. The people, regardless of the wars that have taken place in the past, the people are, I think, a great people. They have great respect for each other. They have a beautiful language and culture. And our church there is certainly making its headway. If it wouldn't be for East Germany, we would have a much easier time of it, of course. From Germany, Frankfurt, we flew to Munich, and from Munich across the Voralpen, across the beautiful Alps, where we took pictures, and they turned out real well, even though they were out of the window of an airplane. And we flew to Rome. Here we visited the usual sites that a teacher of the New Testament or the classical world would visit, the old Roman Forum, the ruins, the catacombs of the Christians, and some of the Catholic shrines, and looked at some of the old Bible manuscripts in the various libraries and museums. Well, to say the least, Rome also was quite a city. From Rome and Italy, we took a plane to Athens in Greece. And here we climbed the Acropolis and the Sidon Mars Hill, where the Lord, where Paul talked with the philosophers, which is described in Acts 17, took a tour over to Old Corinth, where Paul no doubt wrote the great epistle to Romans. Well, Greece to me, with its water and its beautiful sea and its beautiful mountains and islands, is one of the most beautiful countries we've been in. I would say that the two most beautiful countries we're in were Greece and Hawaii and South India, if it weren't so hot there. From there, of course, we flew to Beirut in Lebanon, where our boys landed some months ago, you recall, regarding the landing for the army there. And in Beirut, we were looking into the possibility of making a new establishment of our church, which was decided at the San Francisco Convention. And here also to possibly send a pastor. You will hear about Mr. Egerstrand, who's graduating from our seminary and took a colloquy this year. Our seminary in Springfield, that is. And he'll be going to Beirut soon, I believe. There was our great penetration for the Middle East and the Muslim world. From Beirut in Lebanon, we flew 300 miles south to Jerusalem. We were also in Bethlehem and Jericho in the Jordan Valley and Galilee. traveled around Palestine for 2-3 days with very fine guides. I would say that Palestine today is one of the most barren countries we've ever been in. We cannot see why anybody today would fight for it, would want it. Even the old shrines of Jesus and the apostles have been covered over with commercialism to such an extent that one doesn't really enjoy them. But yet to be there where our Lord was and walked and taught and died and rose again, ascended into heaven, certainly was a great thrill. I cannot, in this short time, tell you all the emotions and feelings that we have, because we want to give you some impressions and also some answers to your questions that you sent me by mail before this tape is finished. From Jerusalem, we flew back to Beirut by plane, of course, and from there we flew to, in a long jaunt with a large British Comet plane, one we were a little bit fearful of because several of them have disintegrated in the atmosphere, or stratosphere, we should say, where they fly about 50,000 feet. We flew from Beirut to Karachi in East Pakistan, where we then got another jet plane for Bombay, India. Oh, a massive, throbbing city with humanity, as many people on the sidewalks as there are in the homes and the stores, day and night. From Bombay to Bangalore in the mountains, a beautiful city where the government likes to have its meetings. They were having a congressional meeting while we were there. Nehru and his henchmen were there. From there, we flew south to our work in Trivandrum, which is in South India, down to Nagarkoil, where the seminary is, and there we were for about 10 days attending this wonderful convention that of the India Evangelical Lutheran Church. It was a thrill to see these native pastors who we have trained out of Hinduism and paganism speak the theology and preach it and teach it in their own language the same as we do here at home. To hear the layman speak of spreading the gospel. One of the great things of this meeting was the way that they talked about evangelism, about they themselves meeting the rest of the pagan world and India itself. And for instance, while we were there, they decided also to send a missionary, an Indian missionary, from India to the Philippine Islands to work among the Muslims there, among the Hindus. There are a great number of them in certain parts of the Philippine Islands. Well, it was a great thrill to see our church in action in India, but we could not stay there any longer. From there, we flew from back to Bombay and then over to Bangkok, and from Bangkok to Hong Kong, where we have, again, just thousands, yea, millions of people piled together among those few hills and valleys in a crowded situation that's unbelievable. But Hong Kong is a beautiful city. It has its good parts as well as its bad parts. The refugees are the ones who have the difficulty, and it is among these people that we are primarily working today. From Hong Kong, we flew to the Philippine Islands, to where we were establishing a seminary. At all these places, we talked seminary problems over with the men. And from the Philippine Islands, we flew to Formosa, Taiwan, where Chiang Kai-shek is. We went from one end of the island to another there to find out whether we should move our seminary or not, and to what extent we should go into work among the Taiwanese themselves, because in Formosa, much of the population is from China. They speak Chinese language, Mandarin, same as they would in Hong Kong or in China itself. We have been doing work among these people, but now we want to go among the native Taiwanese, which they look like the Chinese, and they appear like them in their culture, but their language is a little different and a little more difficult. So our missionaries are going to branch out in Taiwanese in Formosa, thinking that someday the Chinese people who are there, at least our Chinese pastors, may be allowed to go back to the mainland of China, at least to Hong Kong. From there, we flew to Okinawa, the American rock fortress in the Pacific, which is one of the greatest transplantation of cultures you've ever seen. It's American from beginning to end, and it's way out there alone in the world. From there, we flew to Tokyo, to Japan, the next great country outside of Germany, we would feel. India is a third in the race for progress in science and so forth, but Japan, as we feel, is the country to watch. Even though they have gone through a war with us and were defeated, yet they're on the rise. They are a cultured, a brilliant, a learned, people who are producing in population so fast that they don't know what to do with the people. Tokyo has had so many millions of people in it that no one really knows how many people are there. I never really got out of Tokyo. You have to go into the sea to get away from Tokyo. So this is an island or islands which is practically packed from one end to another. And the pressure of Hinduism and Shintoism is rising in Japan. And one wonders just how much we really can do there, but we always trust in the Lord and in His Word, and we are going to continue with your prayers and the prayers of the rest of the church. From Japan, we wanted to go to Korea, but time did not allow us, but we are doing some initial work there at present. But from we didn't get there. Dr. Kupelman is going to visit there for our board shortly. So from here we flew to Hawaii, where Dr. Harms also wanted to look into our work on the island of Oahu and several other outposts we have in Hawaii to see how things were going there, particularly in the areas of education and integration. Hawaii is certainly a beautiful place. Here is paradise. It has everything put together in a small place that all the other countries have. Sea, ocean, air, atmosphere, mountains, beautiful scenery, high standard of living, cleanliness. The climate is just outstanding. Well, this is the ocean paradise, and we're happy that Hawaii is a part of the great USA. Our missionaries, who are really their pastors now because most of the congregations there are self-supporting, are going ahead very well, and we praise the Lord for the way things are going in Hawaii. After our visit to Hawaii and a little restful sleep in a hotel where we didn't have to attend so many meetings, and a dive into the surf at Waikiki Beach, about the only time we took out for pleasure all along the way, except the great pleasure of doing the work of the Lord, we took another jet plane for Los Angeles and arrived there 50 days later in the afternoon. And in that evening, we were back in St. Louis, where we met our loved ones once more. That, in general, and in a rather loose, flowing, disjointed way, because I am just speaking here just with a few notes, is the way our trip to 15 different countries, covering over 28,000 miles by air, began, where it went, where it ended. Now I would like to give you a few general impressions that were given me, and Dr. Harms, and Mrs. Harms also was with us, by the way, as we made this tour around the world on behalf of the missions of our church. I have these impressions divided under two categories. The first one comprises general impressions about the world, and the other is impressions about the mission field. Then following these impressions, I'm going to take up the questions which you sent to me and try to answer them on the basis of all these things and be more specific as I address myself to them themselves. The first impression that one gets today from making a trip such as we did clear around the globe by air is not just that the world is round. Just now I can say from documentary evidence that the world is round. Just how round or just exactly what shape, scientists don't agree. But you can travel one way and keep going and come back to where you started. The other thing today is how small it really is. And with what speed one can travel around the world. I think this is one of the outstanding things. You know, this trip that we took in behalf of missions is simply the forerunner of many, and we think it's going to change the aspect of world missions and the outreach of our church a great deal. This trip that we took was not a costly one. It didn't cost near as much as such a trip would like this by boat, where you have so many meals and such long times. For instance, we spend only 5% of our time traveling. Sometimes we had meetings in two different countries on the same day. And we had a time to spend in these countries. We saw and heard a great deal. The trip which we took in 50 days by boat would take about 9 months. Some say a year if you wanted to go to all the places that we went. So indeed it is a time of speed. For instance, the Comet jet plane which we took from Beirut to Karachi, on the way to Bombay, flew at 50,000 feet at 610 miles an hour with a tailwind we happened to have in the stratosphere, they said at that time, and at a temperature of 60 degrees below zero outside. And yet it's so quiet that you can set a glass of water on the sill, the windowsill of the plane, and it won't tip or even shake all the way. So it is with tremendous speed that you can get around the world today. Jet travel has changed the world. Another great impression that we had is that, in my opinion, America is not despised and hated for its wealth and prestige and progress around the world as much as people said it was. The great difficulty that America has in its relationship to the rest of the world, of course, is that we try to get near to these people possibly in the wrong way. Frankly, I know you can get closer to the people with the gospel and with yourself and with your love than you can if you just hand them money. They're interested in being treated as people. Another difficulty we have is the way some Americans act when they get over in these other countries, because very often, I believe, the wrong people get to the various countries, and then they start showing off or exhibiting themselves or carrying on in such a way that makes people think that our whole nation is composed of people who are irresponsible. And I believe another great influence regarding America in the other countries of the world is that we are known mainly by our moving pictures. For instance, in India, thousands of people go to the movies each week. In fact, they have late showings of American movies every night after 10 o'clock. And you can see the people going in droves. After all, there's no TV, there's not a great deal of radio. There isn't anything else in these countries to do. The movie is the thing. Now, some of the films which are shown there are the same ones that are shown in our own country. But in our own country, they are stripped and censored. There they are not. And I know from the theater that we attended that the people get the wrong idea about us. Another thing is they don't differentiate a bit between Americans. If you're American, or no matter what church you belong to, you're American or a Christian. They put you all together. And you're judged by whether a soldier commits an evil deed in a country or whether a missionary does. It makes no difference. We're all one part of one cloth. Another impression you get around the world is that the so-called population bomb, which people are speaking of today, you've all read of the great population increase around the world, which people are worried about economically, is something of an awful reality. In India, for instance, we were told by one of the government officials there that last year India increased its industrial and output by about 12%. But the population increased 17%, so they lost 5% in this great progress. There are people everywhere in India. This is also so true in China. And as I said before, in Japan, in a city like Tokyo, which is Western in all of its outlook. When you walk down the street in Tokyo, you think you're in Los Angeles or New York or St. Louis, Sioux City, Iowa. And yet, at the same time, underneath these Western dresses and clothing, there are, in the minds of these people, there is the feeling of old Shintoism and heathenism. And as a result, we have a tremendous task laid out before us. But someday, the world, of course, is going to have to deal with the great population increase. I don't think we can do this by controlling of the birth or somehow getting rid of people who in these other countries who are not up to par physically or mentally. Now, the great solution still, to our mind, is the sharing of love and things And we'll have to get along in this room. There's still plenty of room. God in his own way will handle this great problem, but I do not want to underestimate as you look around the world today. Another impression about politics, foreign policy. I believe that America is doing quite well in its foreign policy. I don't know what else it could be doing in these countries. They don't want us to rule them. They don't want us to give them everything. In most instances, they take what we give them, but I believe they resent it, the hand that feeds them. But we do have some real difficulties in places like the Philippine Islands and our dealings with Japan and in the Pacific particularly. Here our foreign policy, I think, could be a little sharper. Here we could be doing more, I think, for some areas and pulling back in others. But one thing I don't believe our government should let our men and our soldiers and our country as itself be pushed around in some of the areas as it is. For instance, in Formosa and Taiwan, it would seem to me that we could expect a little bit more of Chiang Kai-shek and his regime than we are. Because there are 62 cents of every dollar this regime spends comes from American taxpayers' money. And I don't believe they always use it in the correct way. But nevertheless, friends, let's remember that this line of defense which has been set up in Japan and Formosa and Okinawa and all the way around must be there. Whether we would support Chiang Kai-shek or we support Japan or some other people, this line must be kept there. This is evident when you're out there. It's so close, we couldn't let the line come any closer to us because of the great danger involved. If we want protection from military, it has to be there, I would say, or possibly not at all. So at all costs, we must keep our line of defense both in the east and the west. Nationalism and heathenism, heathen thinking is on the rise everywhere. Our church is trying to prepare itself for this under the policy of the so-called indigenous church. That is a church which grows out of, is supported by, and is a part of the country and the culture in which we find it. We simply come and instigate it and give it to them. This means it has to be started in a low level, or a level at least with the level of the culture of the people, that we must not set them up too high so that they cannot pay for it, like buying a poor man in our country a $50,000 home and expecting him to pay the taxes and the upkeep when the only thing he could do was possibly buy food. So we must be very careful with how we do mission work in these countries, because nationalism and this feeling of oneness in these countries is rising to such an extent here and there. India is said to be this way. I didn't feel it as much as some have said, but I know that in time we may have to move out of India. This is being felt also in places like Japan. And heathen religions are on the march. They're doing mission work. They are part of the national scene. And here is something that causes real difficulty in the work of the church. Another impression we have that I've noted here in my notes is something about Palestine. I mentioned that before, that I always told my students at the seminary that if I went to Palestine, I thought I would be quite disillusioned from pictures I've seen and reports that I've heard from men who were there. I never dreamed I would get to Palestine. I thought maybe if God willed sometime I might get back to the home of my father and mother and in Germany and England. But to get to Palestine and all these other places, I never dreamed of. But really, friends, to some extent it's a disillusionment to be in Palestine. It's one of the most desolate countries I've ever seen. We flew from Beirut to Jerusalem over that part of Palestine from Damascus, you know, down over what you would call Nazareth, and then farther down to Jericho, and then finally you take a dog leg over to Jerusalem to avoid Israel, because we were in Jordan. Well, as it was a clear, sunshiny day, and we didn't see any trees or farms or foliage below those 100 miles, just a few little valleys, for the most part just barren hills, not even any trees on them. Even the Jordan Valley is barren and naked. And the hills and mountains around Jerusalem are nothing but rock. In fact, it's like snow on the ground here in our country. The rock or white, and it just glares all day long. There's no foliage, hardly a tree you can get under, except some of the old cultured olive trees that they have here and there. one thing I was impressed about Palestine, it's not a just a hilly country, it's a mountainous country. For instance, the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, which we traveled deliberately because of the parable of the Good Samaritan, is a mountainous road. It's like traveling through some of the mountains of the western part of our country. And it's easy to see how a man could fall among the thieves. I would say, as a whole, Palestine is symbolic of our Lord's humiliation and incarnation. There is no place on earth that he would have come where there was less. However, Dr. Hobbs and I, talking this over a great deal, thought that way back in the early days of Palestine, there must have been more trees and foliage and land that had some farming prospects than there is today. But today, Jordan has nothing, just a few places in the valley that they found. We visited all the places in Jerusalem that one would want to visit. We placed the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. I walked down the Via Dolorosa. I brought my good wife a Jerusalem cross made of pure silver, very cheap, or just a few blocks from where the old Praetorium where Pontius Pilate is located. We went to the Mount of Olives. We visited the Tomb of Lazarus. We were in Bethlehem at the place where our Lord was baptized, and we're also at the Dead Sea. This Dead Sea is so salty, I put my finger into it and then put it to my mouth. It just tastes like quinine, very bitter. There were waves on the sea that day, and some of it splashed upon my shoes, and a few minutes my shoes were just white with salt. So salty is this sea. Really that Dead Sea. But it has its beauty, and the hills of Moab beyond are just as desolate as the hills of Ephraim on this side. Another impression has is the great country of Greece. This is most beautiful with its blue water and beautifully wooded the hills and valleys and the wonderful mountains. We saw many of the old Greek ruins. We were on the Acropolis. I sat down and read in Greek Acts 17 on Mars Hill, where we took some pictures, where Paul talked to the philosophers about the resurrection of the body. We also went around Athens. We went, as I said, to old Corinth, which certainly must have been a great city at one time. Today there's just a little village there with 400 or 500 people living in the whole area. Where old Corinth stood, the size possibly of about Sioux City, Iowa, or possibly Dubuque, Iowa. That's all barren today, and they're growing grapes where the old city was, all the way down to the harbor. But it certainly is a beautiful place, and I wish I could go back to Greece to eat some of their wonderful food, to bask in its wonderful climate and sunshine, to think about the ancient culture. Well, those are some general impressions we have about the trip around the world. And of course, if I were talking to you personally, perhaps you had questions you would have about this, about these general impressions. Now, impressions regarding mission opportunities and work around the world. The first impression I have is to get out into the world that we're only making a beginning, dear friends. We are just in such minority in these countries that it's unbelievable. We just have to do more work. We have to send more men. We have to have more funds available. And Dr. Hans told me at least three times, as he told me once, and he said, if all the people of our church could just see what we would see and been where we've been, we wouldn't have any stewardship problems of missions, at least for foreign missions. Because they could see the necessity of the gospel work, whether you look at it from the viewpoint of salvation of souls, or whether you look at it from the viewpoint of saving the world from itself. The gospel of love is the only solution. So we just made a beginning. Everywhere our forces are small. It was a great privilege always to see how our church has banded the earth with the faith of the gospel. Everywhere we have people, but there aren't too many. There are a little nucleus, a little oasis in the pagan desert, if you will. For instance, in India, of all the thousands and thousands and millions of people in India, we have only 30,000 in our church. And they're of the poorer class. We haven't been able to do much work among the upper class because it's difficult to work anywhere there. Among these 30,000 people, dear friends, the president of the church, Pastor Jakaria, told me that only one of them, of these 30,000 people, owns an automobile. And this is an old model. He happens to have it because he got some money from some American friends. The average salary of the people of our church in India is $12.50. Not a day, not a week, not a month, but a year in the terms of American money. So this makes it very difficult to do work in such a country. Sometime we hope to be able to move out of India, but I believe we'll have to continue to help them with some funds for a long time unless conditions change a great deal. And this is so also all the way around the world. There are so many people, and paganism is so dark that the light of the gospel is seen only in a few places. We are not the only ones doing mission work, of course, but there are many, many places that we have to do more. And our board for World Missions is going to try to go into these places. That's why we visited Bangkok and Old Siam. You may hear of us trying to go into Siam before long. Another question ahead is that we are sold on the policy of the indigenous church. That is, the church of setting a church in the world, not that like our congregation at home, like in Elma, Iowa, or having a seminary like in St. Louis and Springfield, or organized just like the Missouri Synod home with all of the aspects and manners in which we do things, but a church which really comes out of that people. That doesn't mean they won't have the same doctrine, they won't have pastors and people and preaching and teaching, but it means that they don't have to do it just as we do or on the scale that we do. They don't have to have churches such as we have or the type of schools that we have. We can do many of these things in a different way. It should fit their needs and their culture and their people. And it also should be of the nature that we can not, that they can be served by pastors of their own people. In other words, we cannot afford to send white man after white man to these foreign lands. We're always going to send some in advisory character situation to help and to point out how to do things, but to just have white pastors serve these people will never work. So with our great aim, and this is why we're establishing seminaries everywhere, is to have them educate their own people to be pastors and teachers and thus create their own church, which is their own, so we Americans can go some other place. This means that sometimes when they want something, we may not give them the money even though we have it, because we want them to do it. The only way you can make them do it is make them do it, not do it for them. And so as a result, we will have to follow this policy of the indigenous church, the self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating church in the country. And if the gospel, and we know it is, what we say it is, the power of God into salvation, it will be also for them as it was to us. We do not expect the German people today to support the Missouri Synod, even though the first people of the Missouri Synod were supported by the people in Germany. Well, we support our own, and we want that other country to do the same. We are proud of our, another thing that the question has, we are proud of our missionaries. They are real heroes. And we also notice that they are quite well taken care of. And their living conditions are very good in most cases. We are very happy about that. Another impression we have is the importance of radio work, and so in particular the Lutheran Hour around the world. The Lutheran Hour cannot be overestimated in its help in doing foreign mission work. Now, I am not a member of the Lutheran Hour staff or have any connection with it, except that we work with it in the foreign lands where they put on foreign religious broadcasts. But if I could make an appeal to the people of our church, I've written several letters to this on this point to various people about it, I would say that we ought to do more radio work. We ought to support the Lutheran Hour in foreign lands as well as much more possibly to do at home. It'll take care of itself at home. Because this is the basic outreach, in many cases the only outreach that we have for people. For instance, when I was in Beirut and visited the Lutheran Hour offices there, which are sending out messages in Arabic to the Muslim world, there was a pile of mail from Egypt, and a pile of mail from Damascus, and a pile of mail from Kerala, which is north of of Jerusalem, you know, in Jordan. People who are asking questions and studying Bible classes in their own language in that part of the world. Without the mission outreach of the Lutheran hour, this could never be done. Another thing that impression we had is, and a shortcoming of our church around the world, is that we are not supplying enough literature to the Christian people of the world, particularly our own people in these mission stations around the world. The adage out in the Far East, like China and India, is that the missionaries taught the people how to read, but the communists are giving them the material to read, and it's in their own philosophy, in of course. So we'll have to step up our literary program. We have to produce men from our seminaries who are translators in English, who can place into the languages of the various countries of the world our great theology, our prayer books, and our liturgies, and so they can have libraries of theology as we have in this country, in the country in which they have, in which they are. Because without the literary program, we will certainly be short. Well, these are some of the impressions. We have several more, but the time is running out, and I want to answer these questions which you have sent to me through the chairman of your society, Mrs. Eldon Brown. The first question which is addressed to me, and possibly you've seen copies of these questions, if you haven't, I'm going to read them and then answer them. The first question that is addressed to me about our words here is this. What was the primary purpose of your visitation? Now, I have said something of that in my introductory remarks, which you placed on the tape. But I would say the primary purpose of our visitation was to visit the young church in India and attend its first convention as a sister church of the Missouri Synod. There were many things which could happen in a young church like this. We are supporting them almost all of the way, supporting their whole budget. We put in, I think, $280,000 a year or more. I'm not quite sure on that figure. We are paying most of the budget, and above all, we wanted them to know how we felt in about adoption and policy and missionary outreach and so on. So this was our prime objective. The other purposes, of course, were to visit all the fields once, and a member of the Board for Foreign Missions, and also a member of the Presidium, or President of Senate, and see just how we could help the work, and also spend the money which the people such as you, and your goodwill and prayer for our work, give to the work of the Lord. We do not want to waste this money, since we have so little of it, let us say, and compared to the needs, we don't want to waste it. We want to spend it the best way we can. So we think that the cost of the trip will pay it for itself in the long run. And as I said, another purpose of the visitation was to look into various seminaries. You see, we have two seminaries that our people know very well at St. Louis and Springfield, but you know that we have 12 other seminaries which are under the jurisdiction of the Board for World Missions around the world. Now, whether these seminaries are large or small, we must put our best into them. They must have good objectives, a good curriculum. We must know why we have them. The work of training pastors in an indigenous church, as you can see, is very closely related to the whole policy of doing missionary. So this is another reason that we went to talk to the men who are at our seminaries all around the world and to see if we can help them and get better and get a better knowledge of them so we can make better decisions at home. Number two, what countries did you visit? I believe I've already answered that question. In all, there were about 15. Some of them we did not stay in as long as others because our purpose is varied. But most of the time we spent at least 3 or 4 days in a given country. This meant that we would have meetings in the morning and in the afternoon and also in the evening. And sometimes if our flight was far enough, we didn't go to bed at all because it would be morning by the time we got there, and so we would have meetings again. The itinerary was closely planned, and when we landed at a given place, the whole 3 days was outlined for us up to even 15 minutes of time. So we really accomplished a lot. I think we did most of our work in India and in the Philippine Islands. Also did a great deal of talking and discussing and planning in Hong Kong. Taiwan also took a great deal of time. We didn't have to talk so much about in England or Hawaii because things were going very well there. They just don't have, at present, the problems that others have, and in time they may have some of them. The third question is, what was your impression of our work in Asia? The impression I have of our work in Asia, number one, is that it is very minor and small. I would say that outside of the southern tip of India, where we have these 30,000 members of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, we could move out of Asia and no one would really miss us or hardly know that we were there except the few people that we have contacted. But our work in Asia is very thorough. What we are doing is fundamental. We are in the area of teaching. We're doing health work and we're doing sanatorium work, hospital work, but the first major work is preaching and teaching the gospel. And this is what the people want and this is what they need also. In some of the countries, we hardly need to do hospital work anymore. For instance, Japan is as far ahead in medicine and science as we are in many aspects. But our work in Asia, then, as a whole, though it's small, is fundamental. We'll have to do a lot more. The fourth question is, what attitude did you observe regarding the influence of Russia? Well, I would say, offhand, when I asked this question in Germany, when we were close to the East German line one day, just how do you feel about Russia? Now, I don't know how to understand these answers, but from the answers that I received, they are not near as much concerned about Russia and its activities as we are here in America. Possibly this is due to political talk, possibly to the very realities of the situation, possibly because this topic is before us more than other topics. For instance, in these other countries, we'll talk a good deal more about health and about education and about science than they will about war and stuff. The influence of Russia is strong, however. They do not underrate them as they used to underrate them. Russia is looked up to more now as a country not only of power, but of know-how, as I understand. And in the Far East, like India, there I think you have a more of a feeling about Russia due to recent political events as we do here in America. They are more aware that the Russian is on the other side of the mountains there in the north. And they fear him more than they have before. And for this reason, it seems that, to me, that the line between Russia and the rest of the world is growing clearer and sharper. For instance, our mission is founded in that province in South India called Kerala, where the communists won the last election. Now, there was a lot of propagandizing about politics while we were there, but I heard that after we left that the communists lost the election in the state of Kerala in South India. Well, this means that the influence of Russia is lessening in India. But I believe there are other parts of the old world in which Russia is being received simply because it preaches this doctrine of equality, or false doctrine of equality, and tries to give them more than what other people can give them. Five, could you describe the unique church service you attended? One of the unique church services I attended was in Tokyo, where the temperature outside was 43 or 4 degrees, but all the windows were open, and we all sat on the floor, on mats, with our feet through holes in the floor, at least I was, in a tabiabja, in which there was a charcoal burner to keep you warm. Now, they like to keep you warm with your feet and your hands, but the rest of your body, they aren't so concerned about. It's like sitting outside in 40-degree weather. This was the type of church we had. There was no pews in the church. It was in the second story, and it was small. There was, however, a little organ, but most of the singing was a cappella. The preaching was in Japanese, and the singing was in Japanese, of course. But as a whole, it was a very quiet service. It was longer than ours at home, generally, and after the service, there was much more discussion and talk about the sermon and theology in our places at home. Another unique church service I attended was a little house church in Asagawa, on one of the suburbs of Tokyo, in which only 9 people attended. This church service, after the sermon, took up the idea of testifying to each other of how they became Christians. So for 3 hours, we sat in his little house church. You can see an example of one if you read the last chapter of the Epistle of the Romans. A house church held in a man's house, and he was the elder and the head of this little church, where we heard these people tell us about how they became Christians. I would like to say out of the 9 people, 6 of them had their first contact with the church through the Lutheran hour in Japan. This really opened my eyes. And how sincere they are about their Christianity, and how they believe it. How even young girls, there were 3 girls, their teachers, who, even though they said they cannot find Christian husbands to marry, rather than give up their faith, which they had found in this Lord Jesus Christ of Palestine, they would remain unmarried if necessary. Before, they didn't say they wouldn't marry a heathen husband, but they said if a heathen husband said he must leave the church, he never would do that. So these were some of the great experiences we had in church services. Number 6, what was your impression of the effects of nationalism on our mission work? There is, I believe anywhere in any of the countries there is direct pressure, except in India. That is, no one has said on a given day you're going to have to move out of this country, we don't want you here, or anything like that. But it's felt all the time underneath by the propaganda of the government and the way people talk and conduct themselves. The feeling of the pressure of nationalism and the rise of the old state religions, the heathen religions in these countries, is certainly there. And as a result, one must be planning for this all the time. I think there are going to be some countries soon, like India and maybe others, that we will have to leave. India will not allow us to send anybody into this country now that is not a technician or an educator of some sort. They have to be specialists. You just can't send a missionary. To send a missionary at the same time, you have to be a nurse or a doctor or something like that. Well, these things are having its effects on our mission work. But some men are saying, and I believe a little, I'm a member of this school also, are saying that this will be good for us if the time ever comes when we'll have to move from some of these countries, because then they will have to depend upon us. Now, just how far we should go in this thing is another matter. But I believe the time will come that if we don't move out of some of the countries to other places in the country, the church will never belong to the people, and if we leave, it might die or something. But this has not been the case in Red China, where we were, you know, before the last war. There, the grapevine tells us that the church is still going, however not as fruitful as in the countries where we have our regular work. The question number 7, which has been addressed to me, is, from your observation, what would you say is a missionary's personal or biggest problem? I'm glad you asked that question, because I learned as traveling around the mission field that the problem of our missionaries, dear friends, is not disease, not lions and tigers, not jungle and wilderness, and not even food, although this at times causes them some difficulty to get good food. I would say the greatest difficulty that a missionary and his wife and family have in the world is the feeling of frustration, the feeling of being alone in a country which is just lying there, really isn't opposing you. It's maybe even begging you to come on. You do not have the manpower, the money, or the people to do it. And you simply get up in the morning and say, I'm in the sea on a little rowboat and I don't know which way to go. Then the fact that they're cut off from their families at home, and that sometimes the children do not have the facilities they should have, I believe these are the biggest problems. The problem is not a problem of housing. Our missionaries are housed quite well generally. But it's this problem of being in this minority group in this country. Now, this is I saw it. Of course, they have other problems, the same as we do at home and living and working. But it's not problem of food, money, disease, lions, and tigers, as I saw it. But this is the great problem. This can be very real and frustrating. I must rush on because I can see the tape is about ended. Question 8. What do you think is a missionary's greatest joy? I believe a missionary's greatest joy is not coming home on furlough, or not having a new automobile, or having a big salary. I don't think he's even concerned about these things. The greatest joy to me is, talking to these missionaries, seems to be that they can see the effects of the gospel among a heathen land. And I think I heard a joy spoken by one of the wiser missionaries one day when she said, one of the greatest joys I've had out of, besides working among these people and helping them to our Lord Jesus Christ, is the fact that our church follows us wherever we go with help and prayers and funds and money, and helps us when we call for help. This, she seemed to think, gave her the greatest satisfaction and joy. Now, there are many other joys that these people have in these countries. For instance, in some of the countries, you can buy many beautiful things. There's much beautiful scenery to see. And I would say also that the mission personnel are considered people of prestige in most of these countries. They are looked up to for help and guidance and inspiration. The truth is that when you go to a foreign country as a missionary and his wife and family, you become much greater people. As we say in the vulgar, and I don't want to make this really an analogy, you are a larger frog in a large pond than you are at home. This is because of the very fact that our missionaries have education and they have money behind them and can help people out of the darkness in which they find themselves. All of this, I think, amounts to the missionary's greatest joy. Number 9 is a question, what would you call his greatest sacrifice? Well, I believe this ties into the question, what is his biggest problem? I believe the greatest sacrifice that the missionary makes is not in the area of serving his Lord across the seas, or leaving his family, or having to battle the element, or something such as that. I think his greatest sacrifice is that he is cut off from his own people. And this cutting off doesn't mean that he doesn't have as much as they have. I really believe that in some instances in other lands that a missionary has more in this world's goods, if you just count all up what he can do and don't count dollars and cents, than many of our pastors and people here at home. But the greatest sacrifice is the fact that they are cut off from the world at home, from their own people, from their own culture, from this wonderful civilization that we have here at home. Outside of this, possibly the fact that sometimes they can't get the medical attention they need, this might be a sacrifice. But I've never heard these missionaries talk in terms of sacrifice. They always talk in terms of opportunity. Number 10, where in your opinion is our greatest opportunity for mission work today? Let me finish the tape, and I hope that you have not run out of ears by this time and grown tired of my running voice. Let me end by saying that the greatest opportunity for mission work today is in the Middle East. Now, this doesn't mean there are no opportunities elsewhere, but I mean in the Middle East, in the Muslim world. This is what we're trying to do in Lebanon and Beirut, so pray for our work there. When Mr. Eggerson goes there and we send some other men, his little meekers, pray for them and us so that we do the right thing. Because, listen, friends, as you travel in a plane from Frankfurt, Germany, or from Rome, and go to Bombay, there's over 5,000 miles of territory, and there's 5,000 miles in latitude as well as in longitude, where we do not have a single Lutheran church, and not many Christian churches at all. In fact, we attended the Lutheran church in Jerusalem, the only church in that whole area, and there the church service was being conducted in German. So you see, it wasn't a part of the culture at all. In that large expanse, there is no Christianity. No church. There's millions of people there. This area we must penetrate before long. And with God's help, we're going into that. We think that also we can go into Old Siam. And of course, we're going farther now, as you perhaps have heard, into New Guinea, another country I haven't spoken of because Dr. Coupling was visiting there. And the Australian church is going into North Australia. Outside of these countries, I suppose the greatest opportunity for mission work would be in the countries dominated by Russia. Of course, there's Christianity there yet, too. But I pray, God, that we may penetrate that whole great, great country that the old Saracens and Mohammedans used to run and reign, from Egypt north through Arabia to Iraq and Iran and old Persia up to Turkey. In here, the Christian church must go. And even though St. Paul and the apostles were in these areas and Christianity grew there, the fact that it died out means that we must go again. Oh, the population around the world. In Jesus' day, there were practically 175 million people on earth. No Christianity at all. But